got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here, as always. Kevin, how's it going? How are you?
I am just fine. It was really cool to hear somebody else in my seat last week with Allie being the co-host. She did a fantastic job.
I agree. She was fun to talk to. She was knowledgeable. And I think, you have big shoes for sure, but I think she did a pretty good job of filling them. So maybe the next time you have to leave, she can join us.
Yeah, I love that she knows what she doesn't know, and that when she had a question that came up with a question that you asked her, she'd say, "Hey, I'm not a geneticist. I don't know that."
The world would be such a better place if more people did that. Anyways, well, let's jump into the episode. We have a return guest with us today. And of course, I'm talking about Dr. Jeffrey Cabot, who is a cancer epidemiologist. He's been on the show multiple times now to talk about glyphosate and different issues related to epidemiology. And he just wrote an excellent article for the Genetic Literacy Project outlining some, I guess you could say, rules that you can use when you're reading about new science in the headlines. So maybe you'll see a news article that says, consuming sugar increases your cancer risk by 23%, let's say hypothetically. So these bullet points we're going to discuss, you can use these to evaluate the news articles you're reading and the science behind them, and I think make better judgments about the risks that you face in the world from food or from chemicals or what have you. So with that out of the way, Jeffrey, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Very good. Happy to be here.
So to jump into this, can you just give us a quick synopsis of the story you wrote for GLP? What points are you trying to make for the average reader out there?
Okay. And I have to credit you, Cameron, with having pointed out this article to me and having asked me to take a look at it and see what I thought. And so I think it provides a really good example of what to make of a published study. And this comes from the Harvard School of Public Health, and couldn't have higher, more prominent people on it. And yet, nevertheless, one needs to look at what the data actually were and what conclusions the researchers draw from the data. So it's a really good exercise in seeing how easy it is to make a statement, and we'll get into what the topic is in a second, how easy it is to make statements. They get published, they have numbers attached to them, and then people say, well, the implications of this are, and we'll go into what they say the implications are. And yet, when you look at the cold numbers, very often there's much less there than you would expect to be there. And in other words, that there's a much, much weaker case. And so that's my introduction, and we can take it from there. And so just to finish this intro, what I did was I banged out a list of bullet points for what kinds of things we should keep in mind, what kinds of things we should look for. And I won't read all of them, but some of them are, how strong is the result? How consistent is the result within the study? How many different factors did the researchers examine? Because it's a different situation if you look at 50 different food items and then find one that seemed, this looks interesting, this is associated with increased risk. Or if you look at one particular factor because you have some basis for thinking that this is really worth an in-depth study. And how good are the data that they used in the study? And we'll get into that with the present study. And then how strong is the relationship? And finally, how do the results of this particular study, how do they square with all the other research that's been done on this topic? So with that sense of there are probably twice as many points as I mentioned, but you get the idea. And with that, we can start to look at this this study as an example.
Well, let's first preface this also by saying that the news media had no trouble taking this result claimed in this particular paper and blowing it up pretty big. It showed up across Google News and was very inflammatory. And the question that's important for us to look at is when we look at a scientific claim that becomes a darling of the media, we have to be extra careful because now you're taking something that may be an exaggerated, augmented understanding of a data set, and now you're seeing this thing being extrapolated rhetorically. And because if it bleeds, it leads. And so keep that in mind, too. But could you tell us about the paper that we're going to talk about?
As I said, this study came from Harvard. It used data from something called the Harvard Nurses Health Study. Now, this was a study, actually the second Harvard Nurses Health Study. There was an earlier one, and this is a new second generation, so to speak. And this study involved over 95,000 nurses who were between the age of 25 and 42 when they joined the study. And the study started in 1991, and they were followed until 2015. So this is called a prospective study or a cohort study. So the nurses were recontacted every 4 years and were asked about, they were asked, given questionnaires about their diet. And the information included the intake of sugar-sweetened beverages. And a subset, half the population roughly, was in addition asked about their intake of sugar-sweetened beverages in their teens, from 13 to 18. Okay, so this was the data they collected, and they examined the association between sweetened beverage intake and who in the cohort, which nurses developed colorectal cancer, okay, but at an early age, but for the age of 50. So, and this, let me say that colon cancer occurring at earlier ages has been something that's been observed in the past 20 years. And so this is a very concerning development because colon cancer is really a disease of older age, and to have it creeping downward is something that we really want to find out, well, what causes this.
Yeah, but Jeff, but how much of that is just improved detection?
Well, I don't think it's improved detection, but just off the cuff, I would say that it's not, because as I understand that the guidelines for, you're raising a good question, because if there were recommendations that, hey, we should be doing colonoscopies or other methods of detecting colon cancer at an earlier age. Now the main guidelines have been that for a long time for the American Cancer Society and so forth have been that starting at age 50, one should get a colonoscopy, and every 10 years if it's clean. So I don't think this is a case of greater detection. It could be, but I think it goes back over the past 10 or 20 years, and I don't think there have been recommendations to start doing colonoscopies earlier. But that, I mean, you're raising an interesting question. Do you have reason to believe that that people have been recommending that younger people below age 50 go for colonoscopies?
Well, I don't know that that's the case, but I know that there is increased surveillance by physicians in general because of the because it is something that is, if it's detected early, can be addressed. And all of these at-home kits, I don't know if physicians are using these in a more judicious way because, you know, someone may notice, you know, something not normal in their bowel movements or something that's a change that occurs. You know, let's get one of these at-home kits, you know, go ahead and send off a stool sample, and it searches for changes in the DNA profile or gene expression profile. You know, these kinds of things have really just happened in the last decade. And I just was kind of, and that which includes part of the study period. So I was curious if that may be a confounding factor, and that just was something that came up after reading the paper.
You're raising a really good point. It's not brought up in the paper, which is definitely an issue that needs to be addressed. Anytime you see an increase, say, in brain tumors or in colorectal cancer, you need to be sure that it's not an artifact of more intensive detection. But let's set that aside, since we'll assume, for the purposes of the article, as the researchers do, that there is actual evidence, and the National Cancer Institute has come out with articles that I've read indicating that there's a real increase in younger people.
Well, my first question, anytime I read a study like this, Jeffrey, is where did the data come from? And in this case, you mentioned it was food frequency questionnaires, excuse me. And I encourage people, go look these up, because typically what they look like is there's a list of maybe 30 foods, and then there's questions, and it says how many servings of wheat bread did you have over the last whatever the study period was. And I've seen a number of epidemiologists criticize this method of data collection, because for one thing, people lie, especially when it comes to, you know, how much alcohol or how much food they consume. You know, sometimes there's a pressure to, you know, be misleading about how much you're getting. And of course, people's memories are flawed. You know, I have a hard enough time tracking what I eat over a week, you know, so I can stay in relatively good shape. And you're asking people to recollect what they ate over a 4-year period or maybe longer. So my first question is, I mean, how reliable are the numbers that they're crunching in this study?
Well, that's a key question. And it was at the top of my list too. And there's the problem of how do you collect dietary data? And basically, there are two main methods that are used. And the first is a food frequency questionnaire. And the second one is called a dietary recall. And you can have a one-day or a multiple-day dietary recall in which you ask the participants to record, as they go through their day, to record exactly what they eat. And the two, in some studies, they've used both methods, and the two do not agree, and everyone is aware, as of the point that you're making, that that food frequency questionnaires do not give you, you know, the truth, and that there's something called social desirability bias. And if I ask you how many glasses of orange juice you drink a day, there will be a tendency for many people to think, oh, well, I should be drinking orange juice every day. So that may influence what they're reporting and so on. So nevertheless, what I would say is that for some factors, there's evidence, and the Harvard people do what they call a validation study, and for something like alcohol intake, even though people may underreport, you're getting some discrimination between people as to what their real alcohol intake is. And we know that people, you know, in studies of cigarette smoking, we were able to determine that cigarette smoking is a strong risk factor for all sorts of diseases, because people actually can report their cigarette smoking and do fairly accurately. Yes, they probably lowball, you know, if they smoke 40 cigarettes a day, they probably lowball it. But with food is more complicated, however, because alcohol is one thing and you have it on certain occasions, and smoking is a habitual thing. When you get to food, it's definitely more complicated, and one problem is the inaccuracy of food frequency questionnaires, but the other is all the multiple things that people are taking in, and how can you make sense of all in a country like the United States, where there are so many options for food. How can you possibly capture all of the different things that people are eating, and know which of the many nutrients and the many food items is really having the effect that you're observing?
You know, I don't know that we've even discussed what the association is that we're looking at in this particular study. I don't know if we've even talked about it yet. So,
okay. You
know, so the study looks at sugar sweetened beverages and their association with early onset colorectal cancer in this particular cohort. And the thing that I always wonder about, and I think this is, you know, I think I know the answer from the paper, but for the audience, was this the kind of thing where they took the Harvard Nurses Health Study and asked questions about different associations that might be there, or was there a hypothesis? Did they have some sort of preliminary data that said there seems to be an increase in early onset colorectal cancer in people who are consuming sugar-sweetened beverages?
Okay. Great question. There was no preliminary data. Okay, what they had was they had the data that they collected on this young cohort of nurses, and they noted several things, which make it sound like they're making a reasonable case. They noted the increase in early onset colon cancer. And they point out that there has been an increase in consumption of soda, we'll call it for short, particularly in younger people over the past decades. Okay, so what they're proposing is that there's a correlation. But we should pause and say, okay, fine, but many things have increased or decreased over the past 20 or 30 years while this younger cohort was coming of age. And so we know that all sorts of things correlate with the increase in diagnosis of autism, for example. So what they had was a correlation. And so that as we proceed, we're going to look at how good are their data to actually judge whether there is anything to this this hypothesis of theirs.
Well, let's jump into that then. So tell us exactly what they found. And then once you give us the numbers, let's get into absolute versus relative risk. Because I think that concept of everything that we're going to talk about, that's probably one of the more important ones. Because if you understand the difference between those, you have a much better sense of how big of a risk factor soda is or cigarette smoking is than if you don't. So let's get into that a little bit, if you will.
In among the 95,000 nurses that they followed for 20 years, there were a total of 109 early onset colon cancer cases, okay, which is a smallish number, and this is a rare condition. So, and what they did was they looked at intake of soda, and they divided it into these four different groups. The lowest intake group was less than one serving per week. Then they looked at people, the next highest intake was less than one serving per day. And then they had people drinking from one serving per day to 1 to 2 servings per day, okay, and then greater than 2 servings per day. But in the two highest groups of intake, which is where the payoff is, the numbers were very small. The numbers in the less than greater than 1 serving per day is what it is, sorry, is 14 cases of colon cancer. In the 2 or greater servings per day, it's 16 cases. Now, in a large study, one would expect to see like more solid numbers of cases in this critical group that they're examining, 50 or 100, whereas they have 14 and they have 16. And so this is what they use to calculate the relative risk. So they're comparing these people drinking relatively higher amounts of soda to the people who drink less than one serving a week. Okay. And what they come up with is that that among the people in the highest group, there is a relative risk of 2.18. Okay, so roughly a doubling of risk in this group that has 16 people in it. Okay, and I would say, first of all, that a doubling sounds impressive, but actually to people who work with statistics, a doubling of the risk, particularly of something that's a very rare event, colon cancer in younger people, is not something that we get excited about. The risk from being just a current smoker is like 15 times that of a non-smoker. And if you're a heavy smoker, it goes up to 30, 40-fold increase. That's a large relative risk. Okay. So, but as Cameron said, if we look at not at the relative risk, but if we look at how many cases there are in these different categories, then we see that in those drinking less than once a week, there were 8.4 cases per 100,000 in the population. Okay, so it's this quite rare. And among those in the highest group, there were among those drinking 2 or more sugar beverages per day, there was a rate of 11.6. So 8.4 compared to 11.6. So what that tells us is that if drinking sweetened sodas is actually associated with this early onset colon cancer. It accounts for 3 additional cases per 100,000 people in the population. So this is not making some drastic change in the occurrence of the disease. So that's what that tells us.
But I guess let's stop there for a second. Is that just your sampling for something so rare could influence that number? I mean, a different cohort of nurses would likely have a slightly different number, where maybe that number would go down because the numbers are so small. I mean, am I seeing this correctly?
Absolutely. These numbers are very unstable. And that's actually shown I told you there was roughly a doubling in the highest intake group. Well, that has what's called a confidence interval. And that confidence interval ranges from just above 1. It's 1.10, okay? So it's very close to being not statistically significant, and it goes up to 4.50. So that reflects what you're talking about. These numbers, and it's not surprising because they're so small, are unstable. Okay, so that tells you that, well, how much weight can you really put on this result? So we've seen that they posit that there's a correlation. And they do this exercise of analyzing the data that they have in their study, okay? But then we need to ask, well, first of all, how does this square with what we know about causes of colon cancer and the role of sugar intake or drinking sugary beverages with colon cancer? And there, what we find is that, and this is quite striking, it's interesting, the authors actually have to acknowledge that in their paper. But if you look at the largest studies, neither intake of sugary beverages nor the intake of sugar itself or sweetened coffee and tea are associated with colon cancer in the general population. Okay, so that adds further questions to these very unstable results. And so what do the authors do with that? And that I found very interesting. They try to make a case that their data really are meaningful, okay? And that's what I found. Can I go into that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's where I was going to go next anyway. So yeah, dive into that.
Okay. So first of all, they present their data in the data section. Then the discussion, typically they try to bring out the importance of their work, and then they discuss limitations. That's the way these things usually go. So they say in their discussion that in this large prospective study, and it goes on, I won't read everything, SSB, sugar-sweetened beverages in adulthood and adolescence, was associated with a substantially higher risk of early onset colorectal cancer. Now, we have seen that this is not a substantially higher risk. So they're really playing this up. What we call in any paper I've ever written, it's a modest risk, a doubling of risk. And it's very shaky, as Kevin pointed out, because it's based on such small numbers. And then a second comment that they make, at the end of the same paragraph, they say, our findings add unique epidemiologic evidence that sugar-sweetened beverage intake may partly contribute to the rapid increase in colorectal cancer in younger adults. So this is really, I think it's interesting to see people sort of playing up a result, which is really quite a paltry, is the word that comes to mind, result. So that's one thing. And then I think we can go on. The next logical step is to talk about how they cite the other evidence. And that's also very interesting. But you let me know your thoughts.
Well, let me throw this out there, too, is that, you know, they talk about the mechanisms. And this is what drives me nuts, is they say, well, OK, we've got increases in glycemic index, a tendency to have insulin resistance, inflammation, obesity, type 2 diabetes, other metabolic syndrome that can come from the sugar sweetened beverages, which are high in fructose, high fructose corn syrup. But fruit juice also is high in fructose. And it seems to me that if you're going to propose a mechanism, you have to explain why this other thing, which has a similar a similar component, which you're saying is causal, doesn't do it. And so it's either there's something about fruit juice which is protective, or something else in, because both of them are relatively the same. I think, you know, soda probably has 30 grams per serving, and fruit juice probably, you know, 20, 25, right? Depending on the fruit juice.
Right.
So how does the body know the difference? And why don't you see those differences in the data? And and what I'm guessing is that the people who are choosing fruit juice have different other covariances than those that are strictly consuming soda.
Well, I thought about that too. That's a really good point. I'll make two comments. One, a general comment, and that is that in these kinds of studies, talking about epidemiology and how its literature functions, one can always come up with a mechanism, and usually more than one mechanism, for why for an observed association. Okay, that's one thing. And you're absolutely right. But I think the thing about fruit juice, and I looked at the distribution, is that most people only have fruit juice once a day, right? The orange juice for breakfast, I guess. So there's less, they had even less power to say, and in their study, to say anything about
table two talks about those who had more than two servings a day of fruit juice, you know, and really there was just one case.
That's right. That's what I'm saying. They have even less data, if that was possible. They have even less data than for soda. But I think that for epidemiologists, it's really something that I'm keenly aware of, and not only epidemiologists, you can always come up with a mechanism. The fascinating thing is that many things are weakly associated with colon cancer, with risk of colon cancer. They're not like smoking and lung cancer, and diabetes and obesity are associated, but with increased risk. But they're weakish. They're modest associations. So, you know, one doesn't really have the feeling that one is, and red meat is a risk factor for colon cancer, and alcohol intake is a risk factor, but one doesn't have the feeling that we're really explaining all of the variation in that's going on with colon cancer.
Well, and the other important part for the listener is that there's a substantial component of colorectal cancer, which is genetic. I mean, a very substantial. And do you know how that relates to these environmental insults? Is it really is there a genetic by environment understanding of the colorectal cancer? I don't know on that one, but I just know that there are multiple steps, I think five different committed steps in typical carcinomas associated with this that must be satisfied genetically before it happens? And are any of those really overlays associated with any of the genetics or with any of the environmental causes?
Well, this is a huge, I'm not up. I wouldn't want to try to answer that question in any global way, but and certainly this paper doesn't, they throw out various things like glycemic index and increased insulin and so forth, but they don't get into any of the concrete issues involved in, first of all, they don't have their risk factor in hand. So it would be really a silly exercise to go through to talk about how it might interact with genetic predisposition, right? That would be, right. What would the power be there? I mean, you need four or five times the study size to evaluate an interaction in an epidemiologic study to assess just the plain old risk factor. So I think, but it's my impression, Kevin, as with breast cancer, that when we're talking about a strong genetic component, like familial polyposis coli, okay, that there, and that's sort of equivalent to BRCA, there you have a very, very strong inherited factor, and you have a very high risk of developing the disease. What you're talking about, I think, is more genetic variation that may determine what risk factors you're exposed to, may amplify or may activate the risk factors that you're exposed to. And I'm not up on models using epidemiologic data my impression from perusing the literature is that there have not been any great models for for interactions between genetic factors and environmental or lifestyle factors.
Jeffrey, when I first mentioned this study to you, I remember saying something along the lines of, it's really frustrating that the researchers will acknowledge all of the limitations in their paper. And they did, you know, they talked about how they didn't look at the genetics involved in this. And they talked about how small their sample size was and so on. But then when they go to the media, they acknowledge the limitations and then they go on to the conclusion that they basically were going to reach anyway. And then the media amplifies that. So I'm wondering if you can talk about this. I think it's more psychology than anything, but I find it fascinating that you could say, here's why my data are limited, but nonetheless, you know, this is probably a valid association. That drives me nuts to no end. So can you comment on what's going on there? Is it just trying to get a sexy result in the headlines?
Yes. I mean, it's and it drives me nuts, and I live with it. And here's the dilemma. Here's one way to put it. If you, first of all, academics need to publish, and you need graduate students need to publish papers and need to accumulate publications in order to go on to start their career, get a position, and established people are publishing and publishing in mass, okay, en masse, is a characteristic of particularly of outfits like the Harvard group, but it's not limited to them at all. They're just an indicator. And if you look at the publications, look at PubMed for Walter Willett, who was started the first nurses' health study, one of the people. And I mean, these people publish, crank out huge, huge numbers of paper. I mean, their publications are in the thousands, and they get their name on these papers. Now, I know some of these people, and I have respect for them, but I was surprised that some of these people would want their name on a paper, which you know, just reading their spin, I found embarrassing. but one consideration is, if you publish something and it's a, okay, what else is new? If you publish a result like this, how do you get a journal to accept it? You need to emphasize it's, all right, the beef isn't there. We could admit that, but you have to play it up. You have to dress it up in such a way as to get the editors or the peer reviewers' juices flowing, as say, well, this is potentially important. We don't know what the cause of this increase, if it is a real increase, is, but it's disturbing. It's worth studying. And look, soda is is a big factor in developed countries. You know, people consume tons of this stuff, and we know it's not particularly good for your health. It's empty calories, and maybe that's a cause. So they, in my view, they do this job of dressing this up in the lingo of science. But if you look through it and look at the numbers and look at the way they have to spin it, there's not much there.
Well, on a related note, and this is the final thing I wanted to ask you about, and then maybe Kevin wants to go through some of your other checkpoints, but you make a point towards the beginning of the story that epidemiology, like say 200 years ago, was doing really useful work, you know, identifying the cause of cholera, for example, or finding that strong association between smoking and lung cancer. And there's various other examples you use, but epidemiology went from doing useful work like that to I think what you call lifestyle factor epidemiology, where you're looking for very, very small effects in an example like this, in soda and cancer, for example, you know, and it's really hard to suss out what's signal and what's noise. So can you talk about how that transition occurred and why it's important for people to be aware of it?
Well, I would say one thing is that to some extent, the easy things have been over the past century and a half, if you want to look at it like that, the really glaring things, certain occupational exposures, smoking, pellagra, diseases of nutritional deficiency, these have been tackled, and scurvy, for example, a lack of vitamin C, have been observed and have been identified, and good work has been done. I think that, so to some extent, one could say that the low-hanging fruit, the most pressing and most, the problems with the largest effects on people's health and life have been tackled. So We got, after World War II, what developed from studies of heart disease and so forth was more focus on what's called chronic epidemiology and looking at risk factors for these chronic diseases. And they are, think of colon cancer or other diseases, they tend to be multifactorial and very complex in their causation. So to some extent, I think it's harder. And when you get into diet, as I said, you have this whole morass of problems. And there's the famous study by Schoenfeld, who's at Harvard, and Ioannidis, that looked at 50 different commonly consumed foods that were taken out of a cookbook. And what they showed is that if you look at studies done of those foods, the same foods were half the time were shown to be risk factors for increased your cancer risk, and half the time the same foods, coffee, broccoli, whatever, were shown to protect against cancer. So that sort of points up the the challenge, to put it mildly, of studying diet. It's not that I'm against doing lifestyle epidemiology. I think that's worthwhile if done well and if reported honestly. What I was referring to was the term risk factor epidemiology, where you select one exposure, one factor, such as sugar sweetened beverages, and you isolate that from everything else, and you look at, well, what do we find with the numbers that we can crank out for that? And so that, I think, is I said this in the piece, even epidemiologists, some of whom I know, find this an embarrassing a practice that does that is marginalizes epidemiology as a field. So I just want to say that that's not the whole of epidemiology. There is a very serious, very thoughtful epidemiology going on in the area of genetics, in the area of changes over the life course, in health, and there's social epidemiology, which investigates the living conditions and how people actually live and their effects on health and disease. And these are terribly dramatic and terribly important studies. So I would contrast this kind of work, I would contrast that with more epidemiology that really does have a rationale and does have a justification and is attempting to uncover new things.
Can you give us a sense as to how this gets through peer review? And is this journal that it was published in, Gut, is this a high impact journal, or are most of the things they publish there kind of in that substantial limitations type of publication?
Okay, could one of you just Google gut and impact factor for me, and I'll tell you while I'm doing something else.
It's at 19.8.
Okay, so it's a high impact factor because it's one of the journals for I've published in a journal called Colorectal Cancer, but that to me is a pretty high impact factor for a specialty journal, right? So so what I would say is that that's a question that I was thinking about, and look, who are the peer reviewers that that this paper came to? One has to assume that they were people doing similar kinds of studies. So here's the bind, I think. It's my hunch that, first of all, you can't slam these people for doing, you could, because peer review is anonymous. And maybe they tried to publish it in a higher impact journal, and maybe it was turned down, and they wound up at Gut. But anyway, these people are all in the same, they're all in the same game, so to speak. So many other people are doing these kinds of studies, and that's how they get. And we know they have news appeal, so that's why this keeps going. And nobody except people like me, who are willing to make themselves unpopular, call this stuff out. Notice I didn't name names, but people don't speak out against this because it'll have an impact on your academic career.
Well, you have written two books about this general topic. You basically made a second career out of poking holes in bad research, which I have found enormously helpful as a science writer. But Tell us about the books that you've written and just the general work you're doing in science communication these days.
Okay. And I guess I've turned to this, I turned to writing in the early 2000s, and I got interested in topics like electromagnetic fields and do they cause cancer from power lines and so on, and radon in homes and how big of a risk is that really. So I wrote a first book, which came out in 2008, which is called Hyping Health Risks. And I did this because I just found these questions fascinating. And there too, what drove me was the discrepancy I perceived between what's in the science and what you can conclude from reading the best studies, say on radon in the homes, and what was made of it, both by regulatory agencies like the EPA and others, IARC, and particularly the media. So I felt, as a practicing epidemiologist, I felt I had an obligation to try to clue people in. Hey, don't take everything that gets a headline or gets on the nightly news. Don't take it as representing serious science. So that was how I started out. And the second book deals with some other issues, but also tries to show the reader what the difference is between science that gloms on to these little things that we don't really have a good basis for assuming are going to end our lives tomorrow or the next day, and science that really in the long run, by just plugging away and following a path and going down paths that don't lead anywhere and then coming back and going down a different path, can lead to absolutely beautiful new knowledge, like the knowledge that accrued over 30 years that led to the development of vaccines against human papillomavirus, HPV, and that proved that that in this case, the HPV virus is basically the cause of cervical cancer. And if you could vaccinate every woman in the world, or girl and boy, because it also infects boys, at an early enough age, you could really wipe out cervical cancer. So that was and basically the only reason I continue to do this is because I find it fun. It's also very nerve-wracking, and it's not all fun, but it is. I get a kick out of seeing how how wrong one can be, and how even people who have impressive credentials can peddle stuff that may not be worth our time.
How very diplomatic of you to put it that way. Okay, well, in closing, you're pretty active on Twitter, I believe, right? I think it's at Geo Cabot, right? That's your handle?
That's it.
Okay, very good. Well, follow Jeffrey on Twitter. His books are available on Amazon and anywhere else you can get books. Highly recommend it.
But that's Cabot with a K.
That's right.
Yes.
That's
right.
Yeah, so he's got the Jeffrey with a G and Cabot with a K. So
typically there are four misspellings of my name. So yeah. thanks for pointing that out.
Yeah, and I just say just because people try to Google angry messages to you and they come to me and ask, how do I get a hold of this guy? Everything keeps bouncing.
So it's my armor. It's my stealth.
The force field of ambiguity. That's always very good.
Well, we did you a disservice then by sending people to Twitter.
yes, you outed me. You outed me.
Well, thank you very much, Jeffrey. It was a pleasure talking to you again, and really does help illuminate how we need to look at these things more carefully, because, you know, the devil is in the details. And, you know, when the media sensationalizes, it really helps to be able to step back and hear from an expert at how we can be a little better at asking good questions. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It was really a pleasure.
Yeah, we'll have you back again soon, I'm sure. Follow Kevin and I on Twitter as well. Our names are easy to spell. You can find us at at Cam J English, at Kevin Folta.
With a K.
With Kevin with a K, Cameron with a C. There you go. We'll see you next week. Thank you guys for listening.